Welcome. It is incredibly great to have you joining us for this deep dive.
Yeah, really glad to be here.
We have a truly fascinating mission today. We are going to explore a stack of local Canadian newspapers. Specifically, we're looking at the Shawville Equity.
Published in the spring of 1916.
Right. And we're doing this to understand the visceral daily impact of the First World War. We want to see how a global conflict of that magnitude seeped into literally every single corner of domestic life.
And how local boys experience the absolute horrors of the front lines. It's a profound experience to read through these pages. We really have to remember that these aren't just dry history books compiled decades after the fact,
Right.
with the benefit of hindsight.
No, not at all.
They are local time capsules. They capture a moment when the world is quite literally on fire, yet they present that reality alongside the incredibly mundane details of everyday town life.
It's wild to see.
It really shows us how people processed existential dread in real time. We are getting a direct, unfiltered look at the psychological toll, the economic shifts, the intense political debates.
And the incredibly dark humor that emerged as a coping mechanism.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, let's unpack this, because we are going to take you on a journey that goes right from the muddy, terrifying trenches of Europe straight back to the heated political debates happening in the skating rinks of Quebec.
Quite the contrast.
Let's start with life in those trenches. The psychological toll just leaps off the page in these firsthand accounts.
There is a deeply affecting letter published in the paper from a Canadian soldier describing his experience on night watch.
Yeah, I read that one.
You really have to put yourself in his shoes. He is standing in a trench, peering out into the pitch darkness of no man's land. The paranoia is so extreme that he describes how, after staring into the blackness for long enough, soldiers begin to actually imagine that all the shattered stumps and ruined trees are walking about in the dark.
That plays right into that universal human fear of the dark, right? Where a shadow looks like a monster.
Right, exactly.
But amplified to a literal life or death situation where the shadow might actually be an advancing enemy patrol.
And the tension he describes is constant. It's frequently punctuated by sudden, violent reality. He writes about the sheer terror of a whiz bang.
Those high-velocity shells.
Yes, where the whiz of the approach and the bang of the explosion happen almost simultaneously, giving you practically zero time to react.
Terrifying.
He also details the sheer panic when a German machine gun unexpectedly starts sweeping the parapet, forcing everyone to scramble into the mud just as bullets lodge into the earth right behind their heads. It is an unending psychological strain.
What stands out to me in these accounts, though, is how human beings manage to cope with that specific type of strain. The dark humor they develop is just astonishing.
It really is.
In the very same breath that this soldier describes dodging lethal artillery, he talks about his comrades scrambling for cover and says they look like vaudeville comedians.
Vaudeville comedians.
Right. He actually describes two men diving out of the way of a sausage bomb.
A sausage bomb.
Yeah, for those visualizing the trenches, these were crude trench mortars that literally looked like flying sausages packed with high explosives. These two guys apparently ran in opposite directions to avoid the blast and ended up diving into the exact same spot,
Oh, wow.
sitting face to face in the mud while the world exploded around them.
That juxtaposition of near death and slapstick comedy is a pure survival mechanism. The mind just has to find the absurd to avoid breaking under the tragic.
Absolutely.
And you see this humor everywhere in the source material. The paper prints a great little anecdote about an Irish soldier at the military canteen. He goes up to the orderly and humorously haggles for cracked eggs in an attempt to get a reduced price for his mess.
Cracked eggs.
Yeah, it's a tiny moment of normalcy in commerce in the middle of a war zone.
There's another anecdote on that same page that caught my eye regarding a soldier the paper refers to as Mr. Lovett.
Oh, the tattoo story.
Yes. He sits down to get a tattoo with a small electric needle apparatus. When the artist is finally done, Lovett looks at his arm and sees the words, "I love Joe Smith."
I love Joe Smith.
And Lovett just dryly remarks, "Of course it wasn't Joe Smith, but that is a detail."
That is
It's
hilarious.
a bizarre, funny moment. But then you turn the page, and the reality of modern warfare is right back in focus. The accounts of gas warfare are particularly haunting.
They really are. The arrival of gas warfare fundamentally changed the psychology of the soldier, and the newspaper captures that shift. We have a terrifying account of a gas attack that conveys the absolute helplessness they felt.
It's a grim read.
The writer describes a white mist gathering volume from the German trenches. When it reaches the Canadian lines, he describes it as a solid wall of gray-green vapor rolling in, about 12 inches high.
He mentions the men fumbling frenziedly for their goggles. And knowing how unreliable those early fabric and goggle anti-gas measures were, the panic he describes is entirely justified.
Oh, without a doubt.
They are desperately trying to get these crude protectors on while breathing gaspingly as this toxic cloud simply rolls over their positions.
When you read about that suffocating terror of the gas attacks, it almost makes you wonder how these soldiers communicated with their families without causing mass panic back home.
Right.
How much of this nightmare were they actually putting in their letters?
Mm.
That is where these newspapers are incredibly valuable, showing us the careful curation of truth.
We see that clearly with Private Harold T. Armstrong. He writes home to his sister about his journey across the Atlantic on the steamer Adriatic.
Right.
He describes this foggy, tense journey, escorted by cruisers and torpedo boats, navigating right through the war zone. Yet he keeps the tone remarkably casual.
He really does.
He talks about the weather being grand and mentions he's sleeping together as usual with his buddies, referring to the incredibly cramped quarters on the ship. He's actively trying to project confidence and keep things light for his family's sake.
You have to contrast that protective casualness with the heavy, solemn duty of the letters written when things go wrong. The paper publishes a tragic letter from a soldier named R.J. Davidson to a Mrs. Anderson.
Yeah.
He is writing to inform her that her husband was killed in action.
He tells the widow that her husband was standing guard at the headquarters dugout when a shell hit. But he specifically makes a point to tell her that he died with a smile on his face.
Right.
And that he was one of the most popular boys in the company. He is trying to offer her whatever tiny shred of comfort he possibly can from thousands of miles away, managing her grief from across an ocean.
What's fascinating here is how that incredible contrast between violence and compassion extends directly to the medical front.
It really does.
The effort to heal the wounded was as monumental as the effort to fight the war. And the local Canadian connection to this global medical infrastructure was surprisingly vast.
The paper details the operations of the No. 4 Canadian Hospital, which was located all the way in Saloniki, Greece. The logistics of moving a massive tent hospital to the Macedonian front are staggering on their own. But the funding is what really caught my attention. This facility was funded by a massive $226,000 donation from the people of Toronto.
That is an astronomical amount of money in 1916.
It really is. It represents massive buying power and a huge mobilization of civilian wealth.
It is a profound testament to the mobilization of domestic wealth for overseas care. But the conditions under which this world-class care was delivered were harrowing.
Unimaginable, really.
The correspondent describes a scene where some of the best surgeons on the North American continent are operating in canvas tents. At one point, a famous Canadian surgeon is operating on the vitals of a young officer, completely focused, while just 100 feet away, Austrian aeroplane shells are whistling down and exploding.
The nerve that must take to hold a scalpel steady while the earth is literally shaking from aerial bombardment is hard to fathom.
Absolutely.
And it wasn't just patching them up on the front lines. It was the long road of rehabilitation. The paper gives us these deeply personal updates from Selling Hospital, where the convalescents were recovering. We read about a man named Graham, who was a well-known hockey player back in Toronto before joining the 2nd Battalion.
Right. He took a piece of a shell to the lung. Rather than just being sent home as an invalid, he ended up being put in charge of discipline at the convalescent hospital.
He adapts to his new physical reality and finds a way to keep serving the war effort.
We also see the story of Private R.E. Braids. He was from Winnipeg, a gifted pianist who was the head of an orchestra before the war.
And he lost a leg at the Battle of Festubert.
Yes. His reaction, according to the paper, was simply that he was thankful he didn't lose an arm.
Right. He kept his hands. He kept his music.
That stoic resilience is exactly what the home front needed to read about to maintain their own morale. They also needed to see their local boys as heroes. The paper proudly notes the bravery of Sergeant Joe Bruno of the 3rd Battalion, who won the Distinguished Conduct Medal, the DCM.
To capture a party of German snipers in broad daylight, it reads like an action film. But this was just a local guy from the neighborhood.
Exactly.
The paper casually mentions he was already a veteran who had previously fought the Turks in the Tripoli campaign. He is living this incredibly dangerous cinematic life, but to the readers of the Equity, he's just Joe.
While men like Sergeant Bruno were fighting overseas, The civilian population was fighting an entirely different but equally intense battle back home.
The economic battle.
Right. The economic mobilization was total, and the propaganda of the era reflects a fascinating shift in how governments communicated with their citizens about macroeconomics.
We see this clearly in the aggressive read. Produce more and save more campaigns plastered across the paper. They are trying to drill home to the reader that making war is the first business of all Canadians. The math they present to the average citizen is striking. They claim that saving just $20 a year from household waste could pay the interest on a $500 million war debt.
It is a brilliant piece of psychological framing. They take an incomprehensibly large macroeconomic number, $500 million, and reduce it to a microeconomic household level.
It makes the housewife, the farmer, or the local clerk feel like they are directly financing the national war effort simply by being frugal with their daily groceries.
Exactly. This economic push was deeply connected to shifting societal roles, particularly the socioeconomic impact of women entering the industrial workforce.
With the men gone, women were stepping into sectors they had previously been excluded from, and the newspaper reports on this with a mix of awe and encouragement.
They do.
They detail how in France, women had completely taken over the operation of the subways and the tramways. Suddenly, you have about 1,500 women running the transit system in Paris alone.
In Britain, the shift was even more dramatic, with women who had never done manual labor now working in deafening, dangerous munitions factories.
And the way it was reported is so interesting.
What is incredibly revealing about the psychology of the time is how the paper frames this labor. They claim that these women actually found the heavy, noisy, hazardous work to be a nerve tonic that cured their headaches.
Framing the handling of high explosives as a nerve tonic is quite the spin.
It really is.
It seems like a clear attempt to make these radical social and industrial shifts palatable to a traditional readership. It reframes grueling industrial labor as something almost therapeutic, highlighting how much purpose and empowerment these women were supposedly finding in their new roles.
The paper is also very careful to contrast this Allied industrial success with targeted reports from Germany. The propaganda war is ever present in these local pages.
Oh, definitely.
They paint a very bleak picture of the German home front, describing villages full of women and children in deep mourning. They report that German women were reduced to pulling plows themselves and scattering seed by hand in barren fields, reverting to ancient agricultural methods because the horses and the machinery had been swallowed by the war effort.
It is carefully placed to reassure the Canadian reader that the enemy's domestic infrastructure is collapsing.
Meanwhile, back in Shawville, the local mobilization is highly organized and deeply community-focused.
You see campaigns to send tobacco to the local boys in the 136th Battalion because, as the paper notes, the boys were pining for a smoke.
Those little comforts tethered the soldiers to their previous lives, and the town funded these comforts through highly social collective means. They organized community box socials out in the country, and the St. George's Amateur Dramatic Society put on farcical plays, like one called Pa's New Housekeeper, at the local skating rink to raise funds for church and war work.
It is a strange dissonance to think about. People are laughing at a silly local play in a rink, knowing the money they paid for their ticket is going to buy tobacco for men actively dodging artillery shells in France.
It really is.
But while the community was uniting over box socials, the broader political landscape in Quebec, as reported in the Equity, was fracturing under the pressure of the war.
In analyzing this, we must look at it purely as an impartial historical report of the sources provided in the newspaper. The paper covers the deep ideological divisions occurring within Quebec regarding Canada's role in the conflict.
Very divisive times.
There's a very strong nationalist stance, prominently led by figures like Henri Bourassa and Armand Lavergne, who were giving voice to a growing crisis over conscription and autonomy.
Their argument, as reported in the sources, was a direct denial that Canada had any inherent obligation to fight in what they viewed strictly as Britain's imperial wars. They were pushing back heavily against the expectation of automatic military support for the empire.
The newspaper gives significant space to the pro-war rebuttal. Specifically, a highly charged recruiting speech delivered by Captain Reverend J.A. Elliott at a local Shawville skating rink rally.
Right.
Captain Elliott took those nationalist arguments head-on, bypassing the rhetoric of imperial loyalty and focusing instead on existential threat. He argued that if the British Navy fell and the army was defeated in France, Canada's physical security would evaporate.
He claimed Cerda would be invaded within 3 months.
Yes.
He was trying to appeal to the young men in the audience by framing it as a direct offense of Canadian soil, bringing the threat right to their doorstep. He also used a very specific historical precedent to appeal directly to the fears of the French-Canadian population in Quebec.
This is a crucial piece of his rhetoric. Captain Elliott pointed back to the Franco-Prussian War of 1870. When Germany annexed the provinces of Alsace-Lorraine from France, they imposed incredibly harsh cultural restrictions.
Very harsh.
Elliott reminded the crowd that the Germans completely abolished the French language in the schools, in the law courts, and in all matters of a public character.
He's drawing a direct line for the French Canadians, warning them that if Germany wins this global war and turns its sights on Canada, that same cultural erasure will happen in Quebec.
Exactly.
The implication is that their language, their courts, and their schools would be forcibly Germanized. It is a highly potent political argument designed to unite French and English speakers against a common cultural threat.
It is.
So what does this all mean for the people living in Shawville at the time? How did these massive global and cultural debates trickle down into their local politics?
Well, it influenced everything, including the tone of the local provincial elections. The paper covers the race between the incumbent premier, Sir Lorimer Gawain, and the opposition leader, Mr. Cousineau.
Right.
While the shadow of the Great War and the Empire hangs over the province, the actual political attacks often centered on highly localized systemic issues.
Because even with a global war raging, voters still care about their daily commute and their community's economic health.
Exactly.
Cousineau is reported as actively attacking the Gawain government over infrastructure, specifically the existence of toll roads, and he brings up the shockingly low salaries for local teachers.
The statistics cited in those political speeches are jarring to read today. The opposition points out that thousands of teachers in the province were receiving an average salary of less than $150 per year.
Wow.
To highlight the severe disparity, they noted this was actually less than what the charwomen cleaning the legislative buildings were drawing.
That's incredible.
It reveals that beneath the grand rhetoric of empire, invasion, and duty, there were deep, systemic local inequalities that the electorate was demanding action on.
You have the world literally tearing itself apart over in Europe, but locally, politicians are still having to answer for how to fairly pay the person teaching the community's children to read.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, that is exactly the profound value of looking at history through the lens of a local newspaper.
Absolutely.
A single edition of the Shawville Equity manages to capture the entire overwhelming spectrum of the Great War era. You have geopolitical existential dread, the mud and terror of the trenches in Europe, the intricate debates over cultural identity and language in Quebec, and the fierce debate over the price of a local toll road, all existing on the very same pages.
It makes you wonder how you would react to living in such overwhelming, contradictory times. If you were suddenly thrust into that era, would you find that dark, absurd humor, like the soldiers dodging shells in the mud? Would you throw yourself into local drives and box socials like the citizens of Shawville trying to save $20 a year to fund a massive army?
It's a lot to consider.
It really is. I want to leave you with one final striking contrast to mull over on your own. Imagine sitting at your kitchen table in the spring of 1916, unfolding this exact newspaper. On one side of the page, you are reading a heart-wrenching tragic letter about a local boy who was killed in action, a boy whose family you probably knew.
Yeah.
Right next to that tragic column, your eye catches a completely mundane advertisement for a $5 suit. Or a local businessman offering to deliver barrels of water for 10 cents apiece. You might even see an ad for Dr. Williams Pink Pills for pale people, promising a quick cure for your spring sluggishness.
It's quite a contrast.
It is a surreal juxtaposition. It serves as a powerful, almost comforting reminder that even as the world burns and history is violently rewritten, the daily routine of human life, buying groceries, planting tomato seeds, fixing the roof, and complaining about the weather, stubbornly, persistently marches on. Thanks for joining us on this deep dive into the archives. Keep exploring, keep questioning, and we'll catch you next time.